So now let's join Squire Matthew Bramble as he leaves his Gloucestershire home and sets out on a grand tour, encountering along the way a mad Irish fortune hunter, a coach accident, and a young man who seems to be almost too good to be true. It's part one of The Expedition of Humphrey Clinker.
To Dr. Lewis, Gloucester, April the 2nd. Doctor, the pills are good for nothing. Why would you always be so positive? Please send me another prescription. I'm still as tortured in my limbs as if I'd been broken on the wheel. Indeed, I'm equally distressed in mind as I am in body. And as if I had not plagues enough of my own, those children of my dead sister have left me as a perpetual source of vexation. A ridiculous incident that happened yesterday to my niece Lydia so disordered me that I can already feel another fit of gout coming on. So tomorrow morning, I shall set out for the hot world at Bristol in search of a cure. Tell Barnes to sell the corn off to the poor at a shilling a bushel below market price. Let Morgan's widow have the Alderney cow and 40 shillings to clothe her children. But don't say a word to anybody. Forgive all this trouble, Lewis. From your affectionate friend, Matthew Bramble.
To Mrs. Gwilym, housekeeper at Brambleton Hall, Gloucester, April the 2nd, Mrs. Gwilym. When you receive this, will you immediately pack my spare trunk with the following articles? My rose-coloured negligee with green robins, my black velvet suit with a short hoop, my blue quilted petticoat and the little box with my jewels. Williams should bring the trunk immediately to Bristol, together with a vial of Chowder's laxative. The poor little dog has been terribly constuperated ever since we left home. And keep a good eye on Brambleton Hall while the family is absent. Let there be a fire constantly kept in my brother's chamber and mine. Put a padlock on the wine cellar and make sure that none of the men have access to strong beer. Also keep an eye on the maids. I know that Mary Jones loves to be romping with the men. No more at present. Yours, Tabitha Bramble. Oh, P.S. Let me know if the Alderney calf is sold yet and what it brought.
To Mary Jones at Brambleton Hall, Gloucester, April 2nd. Dear Mary, heaving this importunity, I send my love to you and Saul, and hoping that you and he will take my poor kitten to bed with you this cold weather. You will never believe this. We've all been in such a taking year, but the young master caught Miss Lydia about to run off with one of the actors from the playhouse. The two men would have done each other an injury if the squire hadn't called the mayor and had them bound over. The mistress told me not to speak a word of the matter to a single soul, so of course no more I shall. Then, as if things couldn't get worse, Chowder was attacked by a butcher's dog, which sent the mistress into asterisks. And John Thomas got a fit of the sulks, because the squire gave away an old coat to a poor man, and John says that's robbing him of his park recites. We are off to the hot well tomorrow, where I shall drink your health in a glass of water. Your humble servant to command, Winifred Jenkins.
To Sir Watkin Phillips, Bart, Jesus College, Oxford, Gloucester, April 2nd. Dear Phillips, I am writing to you sooner than I had expected, in the hope that you can quash any idle rumours concerning a foolish quarrel in which I was involved on account of my sister Liddy. She has been at boarding school here, and when I came to collect her, I found that her lack of experience had exposed her to the attentions of a person who had seen her at a play. By the purest chance, I intercepted one of his letters and immediately sought him out to tell him exactly what I thought of his behaviour. The spark did not like my style, and though, of course, he was far from being a gentleman, he became so energetic that I was forced to treat him as an equal. There was some amount of noise, and I believe a sword and a pistol were mentioned, which resulted in the justice being called, and my uncle insisting we leave for Bristol tomorrow. His mood is so sour that I'm tempted to renounce all claim to my inheritance rather than keep him company. Remember me to Griffey Price, Gwyn, Mansell, Bassett, and all the rest of my Cambrian companions. Salute the bedmaker for me. Your affectionate friend, Jerry Melford.
To Miss Letitia Willis, Mrs. Jerome's house, Gloucester, April the 3rd. Dear Letty, I am in such a fright, lest this letter should not reach you safely by Jarvis the carrier, and I beg you to write to me directly on receipt of it. But please address your correspondence to Miss Winifred Jenkins, my aunt's maid. She has been so kind to me since my disgrace, for I have cried without stopping ever since. Oh, what can I say about poor Mr. Wilson? He spoke so gently, so respectfully, and seemed so melancholy that I could not find it in my heart to do anything that should make him desperate. I have promised my uncle that I will forget him, but I'm not sure it is in my power. I wish he may forget me, for the sake of his own peace, and yet if he should, he must be barbarous. Some part of me believes that he is not quite what he appears, but...
Miss Lydia, the carriage is ready!
I'm coming! We are about to leave for the Hot Well at Bristol, so now, when I most need your good humour and your good sense, they are denied me. But I hope and trust you will always be my dearest, dearest friend. Yours, Liddy.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to keep you waiting.
Calm down, my dear. 1 minute won't make any difference in the great scheme of things.
It will to Chowder. Mind him, my sweet. You see, you've made him anxious. Oh, dear. Winnie, do take him quick.
Seems to have cured his constipation, all right.
It's all my fault.
Unlikely, unless it was you who indulged him with a bowl full of hot chocolate last night.
Everyone ready? Next stop, the Hot Well.
Winnie, quickly.
Then Bath, London, the north of England, Scotland. Who says you have to cross the Channel for a grand tour?
Chowder, buy me yellow damask. I hope he's finished.
If not, just hold his, you know, out of the window.
Say goodbye to Gloucester, Liddy.
Goodbye. Goodbye, my dear, dear Mr. Wilson.
Come along, Liddy.
Dear Doctor, it makes me sick to hear people talk of the fine air on Clifton Downs. How can the air be healthy when it's clogged with a perpetual drizzle?
Dear Letty, the air on Clifton Downs is so pure. The ground enamelled with daisies and primroses and cowslips, and the sun shines all the time.
As for the Hot Well, I've read all that has been written on the subject, and the water contains nothing but salt and calcareous earth. Any paltry advantage as this spring affords might be better employed in taking more effectual remedies without exposing oneself to the dirt, the stench, the chilling blast and perpetual rains that render the place to me intolerable. Any man who wastes his precious time there deserves to be fitted with a cap and bells.
April 17th, Bristol. Dear Phillips, I am big with a secret and long to be delivered. There is a woman, not unattractive, that comes every day to the Hot Well with a poor, emaciated child. My uncle has begun to spend some considerable time here, and I have on several occasions caught his eyes upon this woman, with an expression in them not at all suitable to his years.
Oh, the stink of this place. It cannot but be harmful to the lungs of consumptive patients.
Like that poor child.
What child?
The girl who is sometimes here with her mother. The woman you were speaking with earlier?
Oh, no, just passing the time of day. Talking of which, isn't it almost 1 o'clock? Won't Liddy be waiting for you at the pump room?
As it happened, Liddy had made her excuses, something about buying spectacles. No, I can't have been listening. But shortly after my uncle left the well, so did I. And who did I see following him back to our lodgings but the woman from the well, now unaccompanied by the child? Observing her admitted through the front door, I slipped in round the back and into a small room next to my uncle's parlour.
Madam, please take a seat.
Sir, I thank you.
Madam, would you care for some hot chocolate?
Sir, I could not put you to the trouble.
Well, then let me say at once, then, that I am truly concerned for your misfortunes, and if this small amount can be of any service to you, I beg you will accept it.
£20? Oh, sir, I... Oh.
Oh, madam, no. Madam, please, you... No, you can't faint here. Water. Glass of water.
You are the answer to a widow's prayers.
You're a widow?
May a dying orphan's tears shower you with eternal blessings,
oh,
sir.
Oh, for heaven's sake, be quiet. No, there are other people in this house. Madam, please, get up.
Sir, I don't know who you are, but may
Providence
bring...
Yes.
To bring such disgrace upon your family. £20! Woman, go about your business, whatever that is.
Sister, your intrusion is exceedingly provoking. Give me that note. Out of here at once.
With these words, he took her by the hand and, opening the door of communication, thrust her into the chamber where I stood, so affected by the scene that tears ran down my cheeks.
Jerry, is the entire household listening at my doors?
I heard someone weeping.
Matt, how could you? A man of your age and infirmity. What kind of example are you setting him? It's monstrous. It's incongruous. It's perverted!
My dear aunt, I heard it all, and you've misunderstood.
Don't you try to argue me. I heard it all, too. Heard him begging her to keep quiet. Heard him struggling to throw her on the couch. It was filthy. It's hideous. It's abominable.
Abominable, indeed. Here, come, my good woman. Take the money and get home to your daughter.
Oh, thank you. Yes. I'm so sorry.
Aunt, the money was an act of charity.
Charity? You're just a boy. You know nothing of the world. Whoever gives away £20 in charity...
I do, sister.
In that case, brother, you should know that charity begins at home. £20 will buy me a complete suit of flowered silk trimmings and all.
Uncle, who was that woman?
I've no idea.
Then it was very generous of you.
Well, I thought perhaps she and I, some years ago, but no. Let me give you a small piece of advice, Jerry. Since I was 20, I've been obliged to pay for 9 bastards sworn to me by women I've never even met. And if the same thing happens to you, my advice is pay up. You'll find it's cheaper in the long run.
April the 20th. My dear Letty, something extraordinary has happened. For several days, there was a Jewish peddler selling spectacles at the Wells. He eyed me so earnestly that I began to feel uneasy. While there was something in his demeanour that filled me with an odd kind of fluttering. To my shame, I found that my eyes were always upon him too. And then today, when I arrived back at our lodgings...
Yes. Well, you see, my eyes do feel as if they're always full of sand, and some new spectacles could be helpful.
Would you care to try these, sir?
Oh, thank you, yes. Lydia, what do you think?
I am Wilson.
Oh, no.
What was that?
It can't be.
Oh, good God. She's fainted. Help! Help!
Are you all right?
Yes. Oh, yes, but you must go.
What's happened? Oh, my poor mistress. There.
Here, fellow. Here's your money. Be off. Come on.
Thank you, sir. Oh. Madam.
Go after him.
What?
Quick, you must speak to him.
But he's got a beard. I don't like beards.
He's a false one. A disguise. It's Mr. Wilson. You must tell him to keep away, unless he wants me to die of panic. And when Winnie caught up with him, he turned to her with tears in his eyes and said that he had something very important to tell me.
I am not a player, but a gentleman.
In which new character he would soon declare his passion for me. Nay, he even revealed his name and family, which, to my great distress, the simple girl forgot, in the confusion occasioned by her being seen talking to him by my brother. What am I to do? Tomorrow we leave for Bath.
Bath, April the 24th. Dear Phillips, 3 days ago we took possession of the first floor of a lodging house on the South Parade, a situation which my uncle chose for its being near the bath and remote from the noise of carriages. He was scarce inside when he called for his nightcap, his wide shoes and a flannel, and declared himself invested with the gout in his right foot, though I believe it had as yet reached no further than his imagination. This, however, was only the beginning of his troubles. Aunt Tabitha's dog, Chowder, having paid his compliments to a female of his species in the kitchen, was set upon by no fewer than 5 rivals, who drove him upstairs with a hideous noise.
The affray was only eventually suppressed by the intervention of the cook and our own footman.
At last, blessed peace and quiet. Ah. What the devil?
All right, Uncle, leave this to me.
And who comes here? Shit! Your name, mister? If you come as a friend, I am glad to see you. But since you burst in without ceremony...
Sir, my visit will not wait upon ceremony. There is a sick gentleman below. Huh? You have no right to disturb him with such a preposterous racket.
Now, look ye, young gentleman. On another occasion, I might civilly request of you the meaning of that hard word, preposterous. But there's a time for all things, honey.
God. The master is seeing no one.
Let me pass.
Oh, dear.
Good sir, I am not... Preposterous.
Yes, John Thomas.
My name is Sir Ulrich MacGillicutt.
Sir, I did my best.
Of the County of Galway, and I have come to pay my respects to you and your good lady and your pretty daughter and even your son, though he thinks me a preposterous fellow. You must know that I am to have the honour of opening the ball tomorrow with Lady McManus. And being a little rusted in my dancing, I was refreshing my steps with some energy. But if I had known there was a sick person below, I would sooner have danced a hornpipe upon my own head than walk the softest minuet over yours.
Oh, sir, I thank you. Jerry, how could you behave so rudely to so apologetic a gentleman?
You should be ashamed of yourself, Jerry.
Please forgive me, sir.
Oh, don't I love you like my own soul.
Oh.
Good night, ladies. Good night, sweet ladies. Good night. Good night.
Such a gentle gentleman.
Where are my slippers? I feel the gout in my right foot. Oh, what is that?
Oh,
it's the Abbey Bells, sir. In honour of Mr. Bullock, an eminent cowkeeper from Tottenham. He's just arrived to drink the waters for his indigestion.
At the cost of mine, but tomorrow we shift quarters and escape this Babel. With any luck before Sir Ulrich opens the ball with my Lady McManus.
You just can't bear people to be happy. Sir Ulrich, I found him so lively.
Quite. And since I'm not prepared to live with plugs of cotton in my ears, I shall find other lodgings where I shall be surrounded by more quiet and less happiness. April the 26th. Dear Doctor, I find nothing but disappointment at Bath. A national hospital it may be, but one would imagine that none but lunatics are admitted. I was impatient to see the much-heralded improvements in architecture. And the square is pretty well laid out, but the avenues to it are dirty and dangerous. The circus is a bauble, designed merely for show. The childish ornaments of the architrave and the iron railings destroy much of its effect. The same artist apparently also plans a crescent. When that is finished, we shall probably have a star, and then all the signs of the zodiac. All these absurdities, of course, arise from the tide of luxury which has recently swept across the nation. Every upstart, harnessed in the trappings of fashion, parades himself here as though he is the very focus of admiration. Understanding no other criterion of worth but ostentation, these people display their affluence without taste or manners. We live in a vile world, and I appreciate nothing so much as the true friendship of a sensible man. You are a rare jewel. I am, as usual, M. Bramble. UPS, my nausea has returned. On your advice, I sent to London for half a pound of ginseng, though I doubt what comes from America will be of the same quality as that from the West Indies.
April the 26th. My dearest Letty, Bath, to me, is a new world. All is gaiety and diversion. The eye is continually entertained with the splendour of dress, and the ear with the sound of carriages. The square, the circus, and the parades put you in mind of palaces, and the new rows of buildings look like enchanted castles. After a brief hurricane on our arrival, we've moved to a small house in Milsham Street, and yesterday morning I went with my aunt to the pump room.
It's not at all as I imagined.
What did you imagine?
I don't know, but it's like being in the middle of a Welsh fairground. It makes me feel quite faint.
Is there anything that doesn't make you feel faint, Lady?
Those women, with their clothes on in the water, they look so hot and out of breath. What are they doing down there?
Now, down there is the king's bath, in which it is essential that every person of fashion should make an appearance, like going to the Abbey on Sunday. Come along, Win. Help me into my brown linen.
Perhaps I'll wait for you in the ladies' coffee house next door.
And perhaps you will not. It is a place where conversation turns upon politics, philosophy, poetry, and other unsuitable subjects for young girls.
But she allows me to go to the bookshops, where I can sit and read novels and newspapers, and where all the goings-on in Bath are discussed. And then, twice a week, there is a ball.
Sir Ulrich McGillicutt remembered me at once, and he's so attentive I can hardly get away.
He's not dancing with Lady McManus tonight, then?
Oh, no, it seems not. Or with Liddy. He's even giving some thought to you. Captain O'Donoghue, his nephew, is a very pretty young man. You see, over there, so straight and tall, and yet he's willing to be your partner for the evening.
I think not. She has a headache, haven't you, Liddy?
How did you know?
Oh, she has no stamina.
Beautiful lady, will you do me the honour?
Oh, Sir Ulrich, you have such energy. I shall be pleased to dance.
Captain O'Donoghue then made a move as though to do me the same favour, but my brother took me by the arm and wished him a very firm good night.
Bath, April 26th. Dear Mary, you that live in the country have no deception of our doings in Bath. If God had not given me the great gift of discretion, what things I could tell you about the mistress and a Sir Uri Micklegut from the county of Calloway. His manservant, Mr. O'Frizzle, asked me to dance and told me his master has an estate worth 1,500 a year, so is not at all interested in the mistress's fortune, whatever that might be. And so, as you knows, Mary, I was always famous for keeping secrets. So although I had no notion of what the mistress's fortune might be, I told Mr. O'Frizzle that a poor £10,000 was all she had to trust to, and what was that to a knight of his master's fortune? He was then about to spin me away to talk on more personal matters, when John Thomas threatened to hit him if he did not give up dancing with me. So he did, rather easier than I'd expected. Remember me in your prayers, dear Molly, and take care of my kitten. Your beloved friend, Winifred Jenkins.
We didn't see you at the baths today.
I've done with the waters. This claret will do me much more good. The sooner we leave this place, the happier I shall be.
But, Uncle, Bath is such fun. I don't believe that even London can offer such entertainment, such variety. Every day here you can see ministers of state, judges, generals, bishops, players, fiddlers, buffoons all jostling together as equals. Nowhere else does this happen except in Bath.
Exactly. I presume you include the Irish knight in this general euphoria.
There are always exceptions.
Well, I hear that Sir Ulrich McKilligut is much out at elbows, and I don't mean his dancing. I also hear he somehow received false intelligence with respect to Tabby's fortune. Besides which, the connection is exceedingly ridiculous. I therefore intend to drop him such hints concerning her expectations as will soon cool his ardour. Though this may facilitate a quick departure from Bath, I think I can promise you plenty more amusement.
Come along, Chowder, darling. We'll sit down here, and who knows who will come to join us.
Madam, madam, dogs are not permitted in the pump room.
Nonsense, we would like to order breakfast.
If you don't remove him at once, I shall be forced to...
you've got no mettle. Get out, you savage cur.
My baby! Sir Alec, you are no gentleman. Do you not know who he is?
Sweet lady, my apologies. I did not know who you were. My abject apologies.
There you are, Jerry. Call my sedan.
Allow me.
Out of my way.
Oh,
to the animal doctor.
Well, now, Mr. Melford, should I throw myself upon her mercy and perhaps be forgiven?
Perhaps.
Quite right. Perhaps not.
There. Another hot towel, Win. Oh, the poor creature cannot stop trembling.
Is he ill?
Oh. Yeah, I gather he was the victim of a violent assault. At least according to Jerry.
Bath is a vile place. I hope, brother, you do not intend to keep us sweltering here all summer. I could leave this very minute.
But, Aunt, what about the ball? Weren't you to partner Sir Ulrich tonight?
You think I could leave this poor creature in order to dance with a person of such inferior culture?
Never fear. We shall leave before the dog days begin. Though, with a little discretion, I suggest we could keep ourselves cool, even at Bath.
I don't know what he's talking about, do you, Chowder?
Bath, May 18th. Dear Mary, the servants in Bath are devils incarnate. So much for O'Frizzle's ruffles and his long tail. I caught him in the very act with a housemaid. I caught her, too, with her lap stuffed full of cold tongue. I swear on my oath, and a buttock of beef and a cold turkey, stealing out of the house in the morning. For you must know, I had already missed some lace and my silver thimble. So I called the constable and her box was searched, and sure enough, they found my things and a nightcap belonging to the mistress. But the squire won't have a prosecution. And now we're all on the wing, and it's hey for London, girl. Yours in haste, Winifred Jenkins.
Dear Phillips, question. Who will supply the place of MacGillagut in my aunt's affections? Answer, anything in the shape of a man. This is just to let you know that we set out for London today en famille. My uncle and the ladies in a coach, as usual, I and John Thomas on horseback. I will give you details of our journey once we have arrived without mishap. Yours ever, Jane Milford.
Whatever can this be doing to my spine? You stop looking at me like that. Really, sister, I do wish you would put that animal on the floor where it belongs.
Where it belongs is on my lap, so we can look out of the window, which is more than you're doing, brother, to appreciate the full glory of the mountain.
When you told me you were no one's doormat, you make a right good footstool.
Get me out of here!
One, two, three. Ew. Aunt, let me help you.
Oh, Johnny, my baby, my baby.
Liddy.
Jerry, thank you.
You injured him, Matt. I heard you.
What you heard was him injuring me.
He's dead.
No, he isn't. He's here under the seat. Alive and... You little tick that!
You brute! Matt, Jerry, did you see that?
What's the matter?
My poor little darling, where does it hurt?
Oh, it's just his dignity, isn't it, boy? I know about dogs.
Matt! What are you doing?
I'm just letting the horses loose and making sure the coach stays in the ditch until the end of time.
What?
Well, what does it look like? Where's the postillion?
Can I be of assistance, sir?
Yeah, get him by the bit, Jerry, can't you?
I know about horses.
Yeah, lead him forward, Jerry, forward.
Here, allow me, sir. Come on, then. Come on, you beauties.
I know the spite you feel for this poor animal, but you intend to take his life at the first opportunity.
Sister, how could I possibly harbour cruel intentions against a creature so amiable and inoffensive?
Shoot him. Shoot him now, I say, before he goes and infects us all. And if you won't, I will.
You are dismissed immediately.
Oh, yeah?
At once. You're nothing but a piece of... I'd not even soil my shoes on you.
Who do you think you are to give me my orders, you old cow? I want to give someone a good horse.
Dear Jerry.
You.
Will you kindly, all of you, leave this to me?
Well spoken, sir. Where would we be if we let women decide things?
Yes, where indeed. For my part, I shall continue my journey to London in the company of the dog. For your part, as Miss Bramble ordered, you are dismissed.
What do I care? That old MacGillagut knew what he was doing. Kicked a dog and got rid of her into the bargain.
Oh,
you just think yourself lucky.
Yeah, that'll do, Jerry. Let's be on our way. The coach is now ready, thanks to your fellow. What is your name?
I am called Clinker, sir. Humphrey Clinker.
Oh, Humphrey Clinker. Well, we're grateful for your help. Now, where's the postillion?
I saw him running off somewhere.
The criminal. He overturned the carriage on purpose.
To find some beer, I think he said.
Well, I know about driving, sir.
Oh, as well as about dogs and horses. All right, you shall drive to Marlborough, and we will find out how much you know about driving.
Dear Phillips, we arrived at Marlborough at about 1 o'clock without further impediment.
My aunt, however, found new matter of offence, which indeed she has a particular gift for extracting from almost every incident in life. We had scarce entered the inn where we stayed to dine when she made a formal complaint against the poor fellow who had driven us there. She said he was such a beggarly fellow that he had not a shirt to his back and had the impudence to shock her sight by showing his bare posterior. Miss Jenkins confirmed the assertion.
White as alabaster, it were.
You see, he's upset my maid. He should be put in the stocks.
For all her pain and suffering, of course. This is a heinous offence indeed. Jerry, call Clinker at once and let us hear what the fellow has to say in his own vindication.
Righty-ho.
And so he made his appearance, which was indeed both strange and pathetic. He seemed to be about 20 years of age, with bandy legs, stooping shoulders, high forehead, sandy locks, pinking eyes, flat nose and long chin. His looks denoted famine, and the rags that he wore could hardly conceal what decency requires to be covered.
Aren't you ashamed, fellow, to ride postillion without a shirt to cover your backside from the sight of the ladies?
Yes, I am, and please, your noble honour, but necessity has no law, as the saying is. And what is more, it was an accident. My breeches cracked behind when I got into the saddle, and with no shirt
you I... You impudent varlet, presuming to ride before persons of fashion without a shirt.
I am indeed, your ladyship, but I am a poor Wiltshire lad. I haven't a shirt in the world, nor a rag of clothes, but what you see. I've not a friend nor a relation upon this earth, and for the last 6 months I've had the fever and pawned all I had to pay the doctors to keep my soul...
The fever come, lady, before the filthy tatterdemalion fills the room with vermin.
So, you're infested with rats. I must tell my doctor. I doubt he's ever heard of such a case. Is there anyone here in Marlborough who knows you?
Indeed, sir. The landlord of this very inn has known me from my infancy.
Jerry, call my host here.
Landlord, a moment, please.
At your service, sir.
Now tell me all you know about this fellow.
His name is Humphrey Clinker. He was a love-begotten babe brought up in the workhouse. Then he was apprenticed to the blacksmith who died before the boy's time was served. So, out of the kindness of my heart, I took him on as an ostler until he got ill. And even then I still kept his job for him. But he looked so shabby and miserable, he was a disgrace to the stable, and I had no choice but to dismiss him.
Did you hear that, Clinker? You stand convicted of sickness, hunger, wretchedness, and want. But since it is not my job to punish criminals, I will simply give you a word of advice. Get a shirt. Get one as quickly as you can so that your nakedness may not give offence to travelling gentlewomen, especially those of advancing years. Yeah.
A guinea! Sir, I can't thank you enough.
Come on out and consider yourself lucky. Come on.
To see, Matt, that you've come to your senses and got rid of that shabby wretch, Clinker. This new postillion is a very smart fellow, a very different sort of fellow indeed.
Allow me to adjust the footboard, madam.
It's him. In disguise.
He has redeemed his own clothes from the pawnbroker. He cannot offend you now.
You only do it to annoy me.
Oh.
If you intend to take him to London, I will not take one further step with you.
Uncle, is that your intention?
Well, I had not thought.
Please, sir. You've been so good to me, sir. I would follow you to the world's end and serve you all the days of my life.
Oh, no, get up. Now, suppose I were to take you into my service. What are you good for?
And please, your honour, I can read and write.
Yeah.
And dress a horse and shoe him.
Oh.
Then I can make hog's puddings, mend kettles, and play upon the Jew's harp.
Is that all?
I can sing Black Eyed Susan, wrestle to the ground another lad of my size, and I can find a hare when your honour wants a bit of game. Oh, and I can dance a Welsh jig.
Can you now? Well, then you are a complete fellow. Ah, I have a good mind to take you into my family.
Oh,
but. You must try and make peace with my sister. You've given her much offence by showing her your naked tail.
Anything I can do, sir, that the excellent lady might forgive me.
Lunch. We will stay and have lunch, and you shall wait on us.
Custard. Where's the custard? Without custard, I cannot entertain this almond tart.
May it please your ladyship's worship, here it is. I took on the task of bringing it to you so that I could plead your forgiveness and promise that my tale, with God's assistance, shall never rise up to offend your ladyship again.
Away with you.
Oh, sweet, beautiful lady, take compassion on the poor sinner.
Away, I said.
Forgive me.
You can leave the custard.
My lady, I'm so sorry.
Let me wipe you down.
You mangy animal. Look what you've done. Custard! Oh, my new flower, it's a silky ruin. Brother, this is a concerted plot against this unfortunate animal whose only crime is his devotion to me. Very well, here he is. Kill him. Put him out of his misery and then you'll be satisfied.
Not here, please, your ladyship. It will besmirch the room. Give him to me and I'll take him to the nearest ditch and dispatch him.
No, idiot!
Clinker, are you all right?
I'm mad. I insist you get rid of him immediately.
Oh, for God's sake, Tabitha, calm down. The poor fellow thought he was carrying out your wishes. He is an innocent.
Innocent as a babe unborn.
Is this what I get, brother, for nursing you when you're sick? For managing your household and for keeping you from ruin through your own imprudence? Then it's your decision. Whether you care more for your own flesh and blood or some idiot plucked from a dung heap. To put it plainly, either you part from him or from me.
Sister! My decision, put even more plainly, is whether at last I shake off the intolerable burden of a capricious woman, or whether I am cruel enough to commit an act of gross injustice merely to satisfy her rancour. And since I'm loath to do either, I will now propose a compromise. So listen, Miss Tabitha Bramble. Either you get rid of your four-footed friend, or you can say goodbye to your brother.
No.
For I'm determined that he and I will no longer live under the same roof. Now, sit down and eat your almond tart. Eat!
Oh. I don't understand you at all, Matt.
I spoke in perfectly plain English.
I accept that it is your place to command and mine to obey. And I promise I can't get rid of Chowder here. But if you'll allow him to travel with us to London, I give you my word. He shall never trouble you again.
Little Tabitha, how could I refuse you such a small request?
Oh, my brother. My wonderful big brother. It goes right to my heart.
Oh, lovely.
London, May the 24th. Dear Phillips, we arrived in London this evening and now lodge in Golden Square. Clinker is retained as footman, and in a day or two will appear in his new suit of livery. My uncle proposes, for Liddy's and my entertainment, to make a circuit of all the remarkable scenes of the metropolis. He little knows that you and I are already acquainted with most of them, not to mention others he little dreams of.
May the 29th. Dear Doctor, as the Irishman said, London is now gone out of town. Where I last saw open fields producing hay and corn, I now find streets and squares and churches. I'm credibly informed that in the space of 7 years, 11,000 new houses have been built in one quarter of Westminster. The capital has become an overgrown monster, and if this continues, I imagine the whole county of Middlesex will soon be covered in brick.
May the 29th, my dear Letty. We arrived in London after an easy journey from Bath with very little incident, and I am now in a constant maze of admiration. All the wealth and grandeur of the Arabian Nights is here. Palaces and churches rise in every quarter, among them the truly astonishing St. Paul's. But even these wondrous objects are not nearly so exciting as the people that swarm in the streets like bees from a honeycomb. Even on a charming moonlit evening, as we arrived at Vauxhall Gardens.
Sometimes I am a tapster new and still...
Oh, such vulgarity. Nobody drinks as hoggishly as the English. Is everyone infected by some disorder of the brain that compels them to walk so fast?
It's so beautiful. I just never imagined all these trees and hedges, pillars and porticos, groves, grottos...
And gravel. Oh, good God.
What is it?
There.
on those benches. Well-dressed people.
Do we know them?
Devouring sliced beef.
I hope we do.
People of both sexes.
Delicious.
Swilling port and punch and cider. Probably just tailors, low mechanics and housemaids, all done up like their betters. Not that it makes any difference. The pursuit of what is called pleasure now predominates through every rank of life. Everywhere you look. Rambling, riding, rolling, rushing.
Jostling, mixing, bouncing, cracking, crashing. In one word, dear doctor, the whole nation is running out of its wits. As for the bread, you would be shocked at what I'm forced to eat. A dough mixed with chalk and bone ashes, completely without taste and very binding to the constitution. But the good citizens of London prefer it to wholesome bread because it is white.
June the 2nd. Dear Phillips, I send you the greetings of our old friend Barton. Not that you would recognise him as the indolent sloven we knew at Oxford, for he is transformed, precise in his dress as in his manners, into a busy politician. Not too busy, though, to dine with us several times at Golden Square.
June the 2nd. Dear Letty, I must tell you that a friend of my brother's, a Mr. Barton, has dined with us several times, and that his attentions to me seem most particular.
But when he addresses himself to Liddy, she seems to listen with reluctance and looks around to include us all in his compliments.
I hope for his sake that I am mistaken, for you know the condition of my poor heart.
While our Aunt Tabitha goes more than halfway to meet his advances, returning each compliment with hyperbolic interest.
And I must confess that my weak head grows giddy amongst all this gallantry.
Poor Barton, struggling with his new persona and so afraid of giving offence, is thrown into a state of distress which is extremely ridiculous. 2 days ago, to demonstrate his new status, he persuaded my uncle and me to accompany him to St. James's in order to introduce us to the great men of state.
There comes the most amiable sovereign that ever swayed the sceptre of England. Augustus in merit, Titus Vesperian in generosity, and Marcus Aurelius in philosophy.
A very honest, kind-hearted gentleman. He's too good for us. A king of England should have a touch of the devil in his makeup.
Ah, the Duke of Cumberland. That illustrious hero who trod rebellion under his feet. Dignity in his bearing. What humanity in his aspect. He is one of the greatest figures in Christendom.
Oh, indeed. A very great figure. I've never seen a figure so great. Ah, but who comes here? I can hardly believe it. Don't tell me. Oh, my God, it is...
The Queen.
Oh, the Queen. Let me see. Where are my glasses? Ah. Oh, there's meaning in that eye. There's understanding. There's expression. Well, Mr. Barton, who do you have for us next?
Just joining that circle.
The one with the busy face?
The former Lord Privy Seal.
Thrusting it into everyone else's, as though he has something very, very important to tell and is searching for one worthy enough to hear it.
Yes, the Duke of Newcastle.
Mr. Armand, my dear friend.
My lord.
How long have you been back from abroad? How are the Dutch? How is the King of Prussia? Not thinking of another war, I trust. He's a great conqueror. Your Alexanders, your Hannibals were nothing to him, sir. Mere trash, damn trash, sir.
My lord, I'm afraid I cannot answer your inquiries, for I've not recently been out of England. My name is Bramble, and I had the honour to sit in the last Parliament but one of the late King.
Of course, I remember you perfectly, Mr. Bramble. I made your brother an Irish bishop.
Indeed, I did once have a brother, but he was a captain in the army.
So he was. And who was the bishop? Bishop Blackberry, some other relation of yours?
Very likely, my lord. The Blackberry is, after all, the fruit of the Bramble. However, I believe the bishop is not a berry of our bush.
No more he is. But you gave me a good scratch, sir. Yes. And I shall be glad to see you any time, good Mr. Blackberry.
Uh-huh. Oh, what a fine old gentleman. What a memory. He never forgets an old friend.
He does me too much honour.
But you did remember him, Uncle.
Oh, yeah. For 30 years he was laughed at as the ape in politics. Well, thank you, Mr. Barton, for giving us such a display of all the remarkable characters one could expect to meet at court. And hopefully it will mean that Jerry will now decide to keep well away from the place.
And so we adjourned. But at the foot of the stairs found a crowd of lackeys, and in the midst of them, Humphrey Clinker, exalted upon a stool, his hat in one hand and a paper in the other, with all the appearance of one selling remedies to the people.
Before we could ascertain that this was so, he had caught sight of us, thrust the paper in his pocket, bolted through the door, and brought up the carriage to the gate. At which my uncle burst out laughing and declared that if Clinker had turned quack doctor, he must dismiss him. I observed that in all probability he had studied medicine under his master, who was a farrier.
Clinker!
Sir?
Have you ever by any chance studied physic?
Yes, and please your honour, among the brute beasts, but I never meddle with rational creatures.
Well, I don't know whether you rank your audience at St. James's as rational, but I should like to know what kind of powders you were distributing and whether you had a good sale.
Sale, sir?
Yeah.
Why, I hope I never be so base as to sell for gold and silver what comes freely of God's grace. I distributed nothing but a word of advice to my fellows in servitude and sin.
Advice? Dear Lord, about what?
Profane swearing, and please your honour, so horrid and shocking that it made my hair stand on end.
Yes, well, if you can cure them of that, you're a wonderful doctor indeed.
The hearts of those poor people are not so stubborn as your honour thinks.
Mm-hmm.
Make them first understand that you have nothing in mind but their good. Then they will easily be convinced of the folly of a practice that gives neither profit nor pleasure.
Oh, but Clinker, if you persuade the vulgar to give up their vulgarity, there'll be nothing to distinguish their speech from that of their betters.
Well, at the day of judgment, sir, there'll be no distinction of persons.
Yes. Right. Well, another bottle of wine, I think.
Yes, yes, your honour. Once, your honour.
Yeah. What a sober, respectful and industrious fellow, and a true Christian into the bargain.
I congratulate you, sister. It appears we have a Methodist reformer in the family.
So, aunt, are you going to let him kill Chowder?
I'm presenting Chowder to Lady Griskin, who intends to breed with him.
Oh, that should be interesting.
She's also a Methodist, and as the widow of Sir Timothy Griskin, she is a distant relation.
Would that make it illegal?
Oh, Jerry, do stop.
She also enjoys a large fortune.
Matthew.
What?
A very large fortune. And I've seen the way she looks at you.
June the 10th. My dear Letty, I hinted in my last letter that a Mr. Barton had been very particular in his attentions. Now he's formally declared himself my admirer, to which I gave a very cold response. But he has persuaded not only Lady Griskin to plead his cause. Aunt Tabitha, too, seems quite desperate that he should form a union with our family.
You must be the two most beautiful sisters in London.
Oh, Mr. Barton, you're too kind. I could not possibly be taken for Liddy's sister. Well, not on such a bright and sunny afternoon.
Ah, what sun, Miss Bramble. All I can see is the brightness of your smile that warms everywhere it touches.
Well, it has been said that I have a sunny disposition, but that is still not enough for me to accept your seeing us as siblings. What do you think, Liddy?
I'm sorry?
Head in the clouds, as usual. Yeah. I said, how would you like it if we were sisters?
I really don't know. I've never thought about it.
Well, I am happy to act like a brother-in-law. Please, be so good as to wait here a moment.
Oh.
Oh, it's so hot. I'd like to get home.
But we promised Lady Griskin to join her at the Methodist meeting.
Oh, I'd forgotten about the meeting.
Why do you always have to spoil things?
I'm tired.
You'll never get a man if you don't learn to cheer up. Men can't abide whining women.
Here we are. Miss Bramble.
Oh, my goodness. The very snuff box I was admiring yesterday. Oh, Mr. Barton, you shouldn't have.
Yes, I should.
No, you really shouldn't. Oh, just look at it, Liddy. Mr. Barton was kind enough to say that the painted goddess was just like me. No. Oh, all right, then.
And Miss Milford?
No, I can't.
Yes, you can. You've always wanted a golden jewel case.
Oh, Aunt, I can't possibly accept a gift from Mr. Barton. It would not be proper.
You'll be ridiculous. I have
it. It's not the same.
Please, Miss Milford, I chose it with great care as a symbol of how I feel.
We all know it's not the same.
How can you be so selfish? If you don't accept your gift, then you are denying me the joy of accepting mine. I insist that you accept it, Liddy.
Mr. Barton,
don't forget to say thank you.
Thank you.
London, June the 10th. Dear Lewis, my new servant, Humphrey Clinker, turns out to be a great original. Tabby is a changed creature. She has parted with Chowder and does nothing but smile like Malvolio. I'll be hanged if she's not acting a part for some purpose which I have not yet discovered, but I do not intend to wait and find out.
Dear Phillips, My uncle is determined we set out next week for Yorkshire, so today I went with him to see a new carriage suitable for the journey. Afterwards, turning down a narrow lane behind Longacre, we came upon a crowd of people standing at a door which apparently opened into a Methodist meeting, and we were informed that a footman was holding forth to the congregation within. Curious to see this phenomenon, we squeezed into the place.
Clinker!
Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Amen.
Liddy. Tabitha, Winnie, Lady Griskin.
And Barton.
Clinker!
Oh,
come down from that pulpit at once.
Forgive me, Your Honour.
Forgive me, ladies, everyone, for interrupting your devotions, but the preacher is needed to call me a hackney coach.
Yes, Your Honour, at once, Your Honour.
Yes. Liddy, Tabitha, come. Clinker, my study immediately.
Yes, Your Honour.
Since you think you are called by the Almighty to preach, isn't it high time you laid aside the livery of an earthly master?
I hope I've not failed in my duty to Your Honour. I should be a vile wretch if I did, considering the misery from which your compassion saved me. But having an inward admonition from the Spirit...
More like an admonition from the devil. What right has such a fellow as you to set up as a reformer?
Begging your pardon, Your Honour, but may not God's grace shine upon the ignorant in their humility as well as upon the philosopher in all his pride of learning?
What you imagine to be the light of grace, I take to be a deceitful vapour glimmering through a crack in your upper story. In short, Mr. Clinker, I will have no light in my family unless it be the light of reason.
Sir, the light of reason is no more in comparison to the light of the gospel than a farthing candle to the sun at noon.
Very true. The one will serve to show you your way and the other to dazzle your weak brain. Now listen, Clinker. You are either a deceitful knave or a deluded fanatic.
Sir.
And in either case, unfit for my service. If you are a trickster, you will find it easy to persuade silly women to support you. If you really do believe in these absurd fantasies, then the sooner you lose your senses entirely, the better. And then some charitable person might provide you with a dark room and some clean straw in Bedlam, where you could not infect others with your frenzy. And so you might perhaps hang yourself in despair.
Which the Lord in his infinite mercy forbid. It is very possible that I may be under the temptation of the devil, who wants to wreck me on the rocks of spiritual pride. Your Honour says I am either a knave or a madman. Now, as I assure you, I am no knave. It follows that I must be mad. Therefore, I beseech Your Honour, upon my knees, to keep me in your service, that the example of your great rank and learning may aid my recovery.
Oh, get up, my good fellow. You may stay.
Oh, thanks, sir.
As long as you perform your duties satisfactorily, yes, and without running after the new light of Methodism. Right. Be off with you.
Sir. I will follow you to the world's end.
Yo, Clinker! Tell me. How did members of this household and Mr. Barton come to be at the tabernacle today?
Well, Lady Griskin brought them, sir. Miss Bramble has been several times, and Miss Jenkins. Mr. Barton, I've never seen there before today.
Indeed.
June the 10th. Dear Phillips, my uncle is convinced that my aunt and Lady Griskin are involved in some kind of plot. I told him that Lady Griskin does seem to cultivate him with the most particular regard. What I didn't say was that the more she strokes him, the more his bristles seem to rise. Instead, I described how I tackled Barton over an improper gift of a jewel case to Liddy. Barton assured me that his intentions were honourable, and he hoped to ask Mr. Bramble if he might make Liddy an offer of his hand and fortune.
And I will give my consent. I can see many advantages of such a match.
Except, Uncle, that I am not sure that Liddy sees those advantages. In fact, there seems to be some aversion on her side.
Is there? Well, Liddy is not so desperate as to worship fortune at such expense.
No, the desperation in this house all comes from quite another quarter.
Brother, Mr. Barton has something to propose which I trust will be most acceptable, as it will rid you of a troublesome companion.
I am indeed extremely eager to be allied to your family, Mr. Bramble, and I hope you will see no reason to impose your authority.
Authority he has none he can use on this occasion.
Madam, it is only
proper. In a word, I am so aware of Mr. Barton's extraordinary merit that I have been persuaded to renounce my vow of a single life and place my happiness into his hands.
Your happiness? Yes, sister, I don't know what to say. Mr. Barton, perhaps you can find the words.
I suddenly feel very faint.
Oh, I do love a man who's not afraid of his feminine side.
I must go home at once.
Oh, I'd be happy to give you a bed here.
No! I'm sorry. Home. I have some pills there. Oh. Forgive me.
Mr. Barton, wait, I'll come and look after you.
Yeah, no!
What?
I forbid you to continue to make yourself ridiculous.
Uncle! I have just seen Barton flying into a carriage, crying out that his heart is unalterably fixed on Liddy, and that he would sooner embrace death than the person of her aunt.
My poor aunt, whatever's the matter?
Get away from me, you treacherous bitch!
What?
Liddy, my dear, it seems that Mr. Barton would like permission to ask for your hand in marriage.
Then I must ask you, my dear uncle, to refuse it. I have nothing but repugnance for such a suggestion.
Can I ask why?
I knew it. You're still fixated upon that rogue Wilson.
My dear, do you love someone else?
I just can't forget him. I have tried. When he came to our lodgings at Bristol disguised as a Jewish peddler, I told him to go away and never contact me again, but...
What a tollop she is.
No, Wilson, I'll get him if it's the last thing I do. Where is the scoundrel?
Mr. Bramble.
Oh, I'm sorry, sir. I did try to stop them.
Mr. Matthew Bramble?
Yes?
I come with a warrant from Justice Buzzard to search the trunk of one Humphrey Clinker.
How dare you enter the lodgings of a gentleman without permission?
On such an errand.
Oh, poor Clinker. What reason can you have to treat him so?
Yes, how dare you? Yes, an errant. Yes, what reason?
Explain yourself, Constable.
I have to inform you that your footman, Humphrey Clinker, has just been arrested as a highwayman.
In part one of The Expedition of Humphrey Clinker by Tobias Smollett, Matthew Bramble was played by Nigel Anthony. Tabitha by Marcia Warren, Jerry, Dan Starkey, Lydia, Helen Longworth, Winnie, Joanna Page, and Humphrey Clinker by Stuart McLaughlin. McKilligut was Sam Dale, John Thomas, Ben Crow, Barton, Nyasha Hatendi, and Lord Newcastle by John Rowe. Other parts were played by Stephen Critchlow, Liz Sutherland, and Chris Pavlow. The Expedition of Humphrey Clinker is dramatised by Yvonne Antrobus. The mandolin is played by Stuart McLaughlin, and the director is Mark Beebe.
Well, that's put a spanner in the works. So does the grand tour stop there, or will Matthew Bramble and his exhausting entourage be able to continue their whistle-stop tour around Britain? You can find out in part two of The Expedition of Humphrey Clinker, same time tomorrow. Now, in celebration of National Poetry Day, this week on 4Extra, the academic Jonathan Bate will be examining famous historical events through the poetry they inspired. On Friday, he explores the relationship between the bombing of Britain during the Second World War and T.S. Eliot's Four Quartets.
St. Paul's was, of course, the symbol of endurance during the years of the Blitz when T.S. Eliot was writing the Four Quartets. Looking down on the streets of London, and imagining how the city must have looked then, bombed out. Eliot himself saw that at first hand because of his work as a fire watcher during the Blitz.
Hear the poetry of history, new to BBC Radio 4 Extra, starting tomorrow at 1:30 in the afternoon and again in the evening at 8:30.
Derek Jacobi narrates The Glass Bead Game.
At first, it was nothing more than a way of developing memory and ingenuity. A music teacher constructed a frame strung with glass beads of various sizes and colours with which he laid out themes, transpositions and variations.
A futuristic fable by Hermann Hesse.
The students liked it and started to challenge one another to do the same in mathematics, physics and so on. Out of that has grown a game that is the most complete possible expression of science, the arts, language, philosophy. It goes without saying that it has long ceased to have anything to do with actual glass beads.
Drama on BBC Radio 4 Extra. The Glass Bead Game starts on Thursday morning at 10 and again at 3.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
11 o'clock now. Today's short story coming up next is by Rose Tremaine. And then Holly Johnson and actress Sophie Ward are amongst the guests joining Clive Anderson for this week's Loose Ends. That's in 15 minutes. And as the giant marrows and tins of peas pile up in churches across the land, what do we really know about the origins of Harvest Festival? Paul Heine travels to Cornwall to tell a tale of Harvest Festival at 1:30. Now, a retired architect recounts his life with his wife and how he almost lost her. Harry Taub reads Ice Dancing by Rose Tremaine.
Let me tell you about our house first. Then I'll talk about us and the kind of people we are. Our house is in Maryland, USA. Our local town is called Cedar, but we're 9 miles from there, out on our own, facing a creek. We call the creek our creek. And I built our house at the edge of it, with every window looking towards the water. I'm an architect, retired now, and this was my last big challenge, to arrange this house so that wherever you are in it, you get a glimmer of our creek. Janet, my wife, didn't believe I could do this. She said, "Don, what about the rooms at the back?" I explained to her, there wouldn't be any rooms at the back. "Sweetheart," I said, "think of the house as half a necklace, and the water as a neck. The only thing that's at the back of the house is the front door." Our creek flows towards the mighty Chesapeake Bay. On summer evenings, Janet and I stand on our jetty hand in hand, sipping a cocktail and watching the water slide by. Sometimes we don't talk. We just stand there watching and sipping and not talking. We've been married for 37 years, and now here we are with the place of our dreams. I began life as a clerk, and Janet began life behind a Revlon counter. And we've traveled the world. We started life as dumb Americans, but we didn't stay that way. We've been to England and France and Sweden and Russia. We've got a whole heap of memories of Stockholm and Moscow. In Stockholm, we visited Strindberg's apartment. We saw his bed and his inkstand and his hairbrushes. He used these brushes to fluff out his hair because he was embarrassed about his head. Not many Americans know this, that the great playwright Strindberg had a tiny little pinhead he was ashamed of. In Moscow, we witnessed a multiple wedding. We were standing in the snow, hand in hand. The doors of a gray building opened, and out of them came a stream of brides, arm in arm with their bridegrooms. It was February, 10 degrees below, and the brides were wearing thin dresses of white net and carrying blood-red bouquets. Janet never got over this sight. Years later, we'd be lying in bed, and she'd say, "Remember those Soviet brides, Don? Out in the cold like that?" It upset her somehow. And yet, winter was her favorite season. The year we moved into this house, our creek froze. We woke up one morning, and there it was. All the water normally headed for the bay was frozen stock still. We stood together at our bedroom window, gaping. We were snug in there on account of the triple glazing I'd had fitted. I put my arm around Janet and held her to me, and her body was warm as pie. "Don," she whispered, "let's go out there. Let's go out and dance on the ice." "What do you mean, dance? We don't have any skates." "I don't mean skate. I mean dance." So that's what we did. We went straight out there before breakfast. We got dressed up in Russian hats and our winter coats and our snow...